Welcome to the Labor Beat Radio Show podcast. This program was broadcast live on June the 6th, 2023. It regularly hosts at 7:30 on Tuesdays mornings, Eastern Standard Time. And welcome.
And I want to welcome to you my two good friends and brothers and comrades in arms here on Labor Beat Radio, J.V. Christensen.
Good morning.
Good morning, everybody. I tried to send a note to Mark Greenberg to come on, but he didn't get back to me. So, but that's okay. The subject is I wanted to kick around this morning was the recent Supreme Court decision by an outfit called Glacier. It's a cement company that. Where the company, all the people who were delivering cement to various locations for construction sites, were told to do a whole bunch of extra things on that day and change their whole routine and with some peremptory order from the boss, and they all said no. And the problem was, is they left the trucks where they were en route to someplace when that happened. And they left the trucks on this. Some of them returned the trucks to the works. Some of them just stopped and left. And the labor dispute started. Well, so the Supreme Court received a suit not under the National Labor Relations Board. Which would be a normal place if you wanted to charge a union with an unfair labor practice. I mean, unions can charge companies with unfair labor practices, but it is also true that companies can charge unions with unfair labor practices. In other words, you engaged in some aspect of a strike that is, quote, not protected. But in this case, they didn't. They filed for civil damages in court. For the damage to the trucks from the cement sitting there on the side of the road, inside the trucks, I guess, in some cases. And so the issue was before the court, does this lawsuit have any standing if the conduct of strikes should, under federal law, be covered by the National Labor Relations Board? And of course, this is this right-wing court, but not just the right-wingers. By the way, the vote was 8-1 on this. Only Judge Jackson, I think, refused to sign it. Or she wrote a dissent, actually. And the court ruled that it's okay under certain circumstances. In this case, the union had apparently not provided a notice that they were going on strike to the company. I mean, that's under federal law, that's not a bar to whether or not the strike is protected. Nonetheless, the court heard the case and found in favor of the company that the union owed the company damages for the damage to the trucks. Well, I mean, the precedent set here is that now what happens now is that it opens the door so that any violence that's or any damage, never mind violence, just any damage, you know, that occurs during a labor dispute, including, you know, provocations by the company. For example, I mean, I remember at least three strikes that I was involved in where, in fact, you know, violence for which and damage for which the union was charged was instigated by the company.
Yep.
To set the union up. And, if that practice goes forward, well, then, you know, what happens is that every time you have a labor dispute and there's any damage that takes place, and since you're having a big fight, it's possible that damage will take place. Then, you know, you're going to end up you're going to have an additional issue on the table to settle any strike. And that is everyone's coming back to work. You know, we're not charging anybody. We're not taking any suits outside of the system. Otherwise, we're not going to settle. So that adds an extra issue that now has to be settled. And of course, it's a common practice of corporations to accumulate as many either fabricated or real incidents on picket lines as, you know, I'm saying. So when you finally get to an economic settlement or a grievance issue settlement on the contract, well, what happens is, we're not going to, all the following employees who, you know, leaders of the union, are loyal members of the union, we're not going to bring them back because they created picket line incidents and, you know, they're fired. And now you can't settle the strike without cutting the, you know, arms and legs off your membership, kind of thing, which is never a good idea. So this settlement, so this decision by the court is just another in a string of them, including, of course, the most recent one, Roe v. Wade, where basic rights established since 1936 in labor and later in other areas are being reversed. It's actually an assault on the entire Roosevelt legacy, to be true, right, in legislation. So here we are. And now I am told that a note on this is that some of the justices, more liberal ones, who also voted for this particular settlement on the grounds that, you know, well, the union never notified the company and they should have brought the trucks back or whatever, that there are other cases coming before the court on this similar issue, excluding one from the state of Washington, I believe, where more of the justices will supposedly line up on the union side. We'll see about that. But the attack on the right to strike is a very big deal. If you don't know that much about unions and you're listening to this podcast, and your bargaining power with a company is fundamentally how much of the work are you going to do or withdraw? That's your power. You know, the companies in business, they don't make money except on wage labor, frankly, not much anyway. And unless they're gamblers, in terms of any real value, they make money on wage labor. And if you're not there, they don't make any money, at least on that part. So I'm going to open the discussion here. We have, the attack on labor is just one of the overall attacks that this court and the right wing is doing. Where do we go from here? What's the, how do you guys assess it? By the way, I want to thank Mark Greenberg and John Wojcik from People's World for writing a first-class article on this. That's where I took about half of this. I actually went this morning and read the decision, too. it's not too complicated, actually. what do you guys think?
Defer to Scott.
Oh, I was going to jump in anyway.
Good.
Okay, Jamie. First of all, I've had similar experience. I know what John's talking about in strikes, and I remember all kinds of, at the Pullman strike is where I got involved in I was in the steelworkers, and when we went on strike, they did all kinds of things to try to provoke people on the picket line and including when we had mass picketing, they would try to drive cars through the picket and all kinds of stuff like that. And it's clearly where they're going with all of this. I think that really they're getting, the reason a lot of this kind of more is heightened right now is because basically the class struggle is getting sharper, and there's more action on the ground from unions and from workers, and that's really pissing them off, and it's really making them, you know, it's almost, to me, it's like headed back to the times when they used to beat up people and shoot people on the picket line. I think there's some evidence that that kind of stuff is beginning to happen. On the brighter side of things, one of the things that I think is weakening corporate power a lot is the fact that now trade union movement is more and more going global, and more unions around the world are joining hands. I know my union, the steelworkers, are part of this global federation called Industrial. And it's already been the kind of situation where, these corporations are all global. You know, there are very few corporations that are just in one country. And so solidarity in other countries, we've won some contracts because of solidarity with companies, with union workers in other countries. And including boycotts and stuff like that. And the attack, well, the thing about a rising struggle is that the attacks are going to get worse. And you're already, you know, you look at like in a lot of the Republican-led states, you see the, you know, deputizing the police and deputizing the National Guard and all kinds of stuff like that. And we know who, when people are on strike, we know who they're going to go after. And so I think it's sharpening. And I think we have to look at more and more ways of uniting the labor movement to fight. You know, one of my favorite T-shirts is... was put out by the AFL-CIO called, and it said, kicking ass for the working class. Mm. And I
said, I remember that's going way pretty far back there.
I wish I had one.
Oh, well, see, we're all on the same page there. No, and I think it is sharpening. And when you start having fascist-like governments, who knows where this is going to go?
Hey, JB, what do you, you got?
I wanted to see if a case like this has ever been brought before. And I wonder if the whole reasoning for it was the legal fees. Because when the court changed to conservative, ultra conservative, I should say, tricky political maneuvering, which has never been done before, unprecedented maneuvering by the Republicans to get these faux justices sworn in. I'm just wondering if you would think this would have been brought before, but if the court was deemed, you know, even, the chances of them recovering their legal fees were probably nil. The way the court's structured now, it's so much in the favor of, wanton conservatism and, you know, turning back labor laws. I mean, this is like the quest of the Holy Grail, you know, when they're at the bridge and they've lost their arms and legs and said they're still going to beat them with their stump. You know, I mean, that's where we're at. I'm just wondering if, you know, this... The only reason they brought the case was because they knew they were going to win.
Well, they thought they had
that's there's a problem with that. There's a problem with that in my book.
Well, let me just say, you know, one thing about I think it's a miscalculation in some respects by the right wing here. You know, if you have enough issues that are going to people are motivated to go on strike, they will do it, even if the odds are improbable. Because, you know, what happens culturally in a lot of shops is that, you know, you have an accumulated list of sort of grievances and bad will, you know, and ill will toward each other. I mean, they're whatever pressure the management's on and whoever the management is, they've decided that the workers are their problem and it's just one thing after another. Well, the people, you know, will go through a period of time and, you know, because going on strike, you never make any money on a strike. And, you know, you're deliberately going to hurt the company because they're hurting you. And it's almost always, I've heard of cases where, you know, workers were going on strike to attack the company, but I never saw one, to be truthful. Everyone I was involved in, the people were defending themselves against attacks against them. And that's what caused the overwhelming majority of workers, you know, to say, you know, we got to stop this, right? Well, once you go out of the strike and then the company decides to punish you after that, you know, an attitude develops amongst the members that says, if you're going to kill us, we're going to kill you. That does happen. You know, it's going to be either mutual benefit or mutual destruction. Now, and so, so it's not going to work, you know, in the sense of suppressing labor militancy. It'll just make the struggle on the line a little more desperate. You know, and therefore bad faith, right? You know, once you get a certain amount of rot, okay, in relations between the employees and the company, well, you know, how's the work going to really get done? You go back in the shop and everybody hates each other. You know, that's a very rough situation if you're trying to get a product out the door, you know, of any quality. It really is. So I think it's going to backfire myself. But
you know, another thing is that if you look at the labor movement today, the AFL-CIO and the coalitions that it's building with all these other movements, with the women's movements, with and you get so many young people coming into the labor movement now and organizing and I mean, and the Starbucks, I can't remember all the names of all the places, but it's just really an amazing amount of organizing going on now and young people coming into the labor movement. And then again, the coalitions that, you know, when you got the labor movement supporting Black Lives Matter and you got the labor movement supporting the women's movement and youth movements and stuff like that, there's really a rising tide of power on the side of working people. And I think that that shows that we've really got a chance and workers really have a chance to start winning, one thing I think we've talked about on the program before that I think is just an incredibly important thing that unions are beginning to look at is that not just bargaining for their members, but bargaining for what's called the common good. And that means taking on if you're in a neighborhood and trash or bad stuff that comes out of the product, and you're saying not only do we have the right to have a union, but the union has the right to say, okay, some of these other problems the company's got to solve or take care of. And I think that kind of rising tide is a really important thing that's going on now.
How do you think it's going to play in the, we're headed into the political season here before the summer's out. I guess we're already into it, actually. I noticed today that Jamie Dimon, CEO and chairman of J. J.P. Morgan, now the biggest bank in the country by several orders of magnitude.
Leaps and bounds.
Anyway, he is planning a visit to D.C. this morning to explain to congressmen how it's important to have more unity.
Hey, Scott, I've got a company for you. Amazon.
Amazon, that's the one I was trying to think.
That's the big one. That's the elephant in the room, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, it looks like Jamie's thinking about running for president. And
what?
I don't.
Why?
See,
huh? Why? Nobody even knows him.
I think he thinks that Biden's too old.
Yeah, but that's not going to help the. That's weird. He's going to run as a Democrat?
I don't know. He could either one. I mean, he's going to do. I think he's thinking of doing a mansion.
Yeah, that's going to be a thing, doing a mansion. That's going to be a thing in itself.
Oh my God.
Yeah, there's a bunch of.
We're stuck with him, Scott. You know, you can have him if you want. You can have him.
Please. We've had enough imports. We don't need any more.
Oh, man. But yeah, I mean, what are you going to do? You go on strike. You have to go off. You have to get on the picket line. You're not in charge of discharging the work that was before you. That's, I mean, right. Did they deliberately load up the trucks to and know when they were going to walk off the job?
They had one assignment and they were given another one arbitrarily after they were, half of them were already on their way doing the right. And it was going to. I don't know. We'd have to find him and talk about what all the individual circumstances were, why it was a real burden to turn around and do something totally different, you know. And they all got, well, and the union, they call it the union agent. I assume that was the business agent or the
dispatcher.
Rep, you know, said, no, we're not doing that. And sent out to tell the guys to stop. Now, the ones that stopped and didn't bother to come back with the truck, I don't know, you know.
Oh, they had guys like that.
Yeah, well, yeah, a whole bunch were on the road. Some came back, they'd already loaded it up with the cement mix, right? And they were churning it, right? And so some of the guys headed up down the high, they were called back, and, or they weren't called back, they were told that we're now on strike. That's what they were told. Business agent, you know, and some of them just left the truck where they were.
So they helped their neighbor put in a swimming pool.
Well, that was the problem. They couldn't dump it because apparently while that thing's still churning in there, there's environmental hazardous chemicals. And two, you know, if you don't do something with it, eventually it'll harden, right?
Sure.
And,
do you remember what the company was?
Glacier, called Glacier. Let me see here.
Yeah, it's on the article. Let's see.
Glacier Northwest Incorporated.
Okay. I was thinking
Cal Portland.
I was thinking about Osinga, which is the guy that runs that is one of the most right wing creeps in the country.
He could have a blood brother in this company easily. Okay, so that's
for sure. You know, this reminds me, remember, and I can't see my memories, you know, don't get old, well, get old, but realize that your memory goes to hell. Anyway, there was a big strike with trucks on a bridge that blocked the bridge for days. You guys remember that?
More than one. That's on one of their caravan things they did, right? Remember? It was that over NAFTA.
That's right.
There was now going to be Mexican truckers that were going to be coming in.
Right. And one of the bridges that was blocked was between Canada and the U.S. And there was just this huge outcry about this. And then I think they sued the union that time for blocking interstate commerce or whatever they wanted to call it. But so, I mean, We've been through this before.
They've always had the ability to file unfair labor practice charges against a union, you know, for bad faith bargaining or, I think, violence, you know, and also, what was the other one? Secondary boycotts and... basically boycotts. Oh, well, you can go on strike, but you can't advocate that people don't buy the product.
Yeah, I mean, how the hell else are you going to hurt them? Boycott is a huge advantage.
Well, that's an issue right there with Sherwin-Williams, right? Because if you could do a boycott, you could go into Lowe's and you could pick at Lowe's and say, don't buy Sherwin-Williams at Lowe's.
Yeah.
Actually, a third party can do that. But if it's an agent union, you'll get charged, you know, so.
Is the third party the labor council?
No, I don't know for sure, JB.
We have to find out.
I've seen it done. I've seen it done before, and I most of the time you're getting third parties, not in the union at all, to do it, to go in and tell people, well, don't buy this and stuff like that. I remember doing that when I was a kid, before I was in a union, people would do that.
That was a great article, John.
One other thing it brought to mind to me. Historically, I'm sure both of you and a lot of your listeners may or may not know about the 1937 Little Steel Strike in Chicago. And it was a strike where against Republic Steel, which in those days was called Little Steel. The company hired police and all kinds of gun thugs and Pinkertons, in fact, and brought them into the plant because the workers had gone on strike and they were planning a massive picket in front of the plant. And when they marched and they marched from several blocks away, and it was a festive thing. There were women and children, and they were all they had musical instruments, and they were just going to do a big thing in front of the plant gate. And the company knew about it, and as soon as they got in front of the plant. And they weren't trying to get in the plant. They weren't blocking. The company opened the doors and the police and the gun thugs that they had hired came running out and shooting and killing people. 10 people died in that. It's called the Memorial Day Massacre. And it made me think about it because we just every year we commemorate it the week before the massacre. And, you know, the overwhelming support we get from not just other unions, because we raise money and we do all kinds of things we have a essay contest in some of the high schools, and they write about, you know, labor today and what happened then and linking that stuff all up. And and it just keeps growing and growing. And again, it's a lot of young people. The pandemic really wasn't so good the year before, but this year we weren't sure if we were going to, and all these young people came, and it just, anyway, I like to talk about that because it's a rising tide of struggle. For labor.
You know, I was thinking while you were talking there that I remember, for example, when I first got involved in the UE mostly in California, I think that it was interesting that I observed that the UE was always, for example, very good at running strikes.
Yep.
And the reason they were was that they had a very sort of rank and file and social, also a social movement aspect to what happens. Yeah. What do you do when you go on strike? And how do you avoid going on strike for that's an automatic loser unless you're going on strike basically to wipe the company out because they wiped you out. I mean, that mm-hmm. a couple of times, but other than that, you know, how do you don't want to this business of going out on strike just out of outrage, and you know, you've never been on strike before and you don't know what to do. And I remember one group of workers got outraged at the way I think it was called Keystone Cameron in Massachusetts. And they all walked out, and then they called the union hall and says, "Hey, what do we do?" You know, and you say, "Well, it's, you know, let's start picketing first." Everyone on the picket line. And, you know, then we, for example, I think it was like 3 hours later, you know, we heard that the company had already arranged to bring in all kinds of scabs into the plant, you know, from the Boston African American community.
Mm-hmm.
Out that shop was overwhelmingly white in composition. And there had been probably at least 10 to 15 years of hiring relatives and all the kind of deals that happen. And so the composition of the shop had never changed. Yeah. And one of my great mentors, Don Tormey, you know, I heard this was going to happen. And so, of course, I called him. What do we do now, Don? And so he came out to the shop, and all the guys were out there, and the thing, he says, "So what we're going to do now is we're going to form just like you were in the army, we're going to form a brigade unit here. Everyone's going to line up in order, and we're going to march like an army back into that plant and stay by our machines so that nobody takes our job." You know, turned it into a thing. And all the people in the plant, you know, because we heard all these people were coming. And I said, once we get back in there, then we're going to begin, see if we can negotiate something. And we're going to contact the owner of the company rather than the guy he hired as the manager and see if we can talk to him. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the whole thing worked out in a way. But as a consequence, rather than have kind of a racially charged conclusion, right, or judgments or evaluations, all those black workers are going to take our job kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was is that the deal that we negotiated with the company was going to change, had to change the composition of the shop. And we did the opposite thing. Because it was interesting that Don, you know, he convinced the members that you want to be protected. You know, you just found out that you don't have any, that this hiring your best friends all the time and avoiding this leaves you vulnerable.
Mm.
And, you know, you could blame all the black workers who are going to come in there and take your jobs. But, you know, you didn't show much concern for them in the past. So why would they have any much respect for your, you know, situation here? And so in the end, they had to negotiate with forces in the black community to help support, you know, the whole thing. And it actually transformed that shop, but it could have ended up in a disaster.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of having the skills about how to lead a strike. What's kind of, that's a knowledge that would be very valuable, you know, for people to have. It's a hard thing to teach in a book or a paper. It's tough to do that way. But it seems like learning some of those skills ought to be maybe a little bit stronger part of union education. I don't know.
It sounds like they're going to have to relearn the skills.
Yeah.
Well, they're going to make decisions like this. They might as well start at the beginning.
Yeah.
And, right. You know, we reinvent new skills.
Well, you know, in Chicago, UE had schools. And they would even invite people from other unions. That's how I got in. And I'm trying to remember the name of the hall. But anyway, they had I don't even know if they still had it, but they had a big hall, and they would I think it was every Saturday for a while, we would go in and there were people there that were teach you all about labor law and all about how to organize on the shop floor. And it was really good stuff. And actually that's happening again in a lot of unions. In the steelworkers, we have classes all the time. And some of them are national, some of them are district schools that train, you know, on grievances, on labor law and all of those, and how to organize the rank and file to support the union kind of stuff. And there's a lot of that. And we even, in Illinois, we have a labor school downstate that once a year, the summer school, and it's sponsored by a bunch of the unions, and there's a labor professor down there that sort of puts it all together. But we have breakouts on different things and all kinds of like this year I'm teaching quote unquote the political situation for unions. But anyway, I mean, there's a lot more of that stuff going on. And I think that's a real important element of fight back.
It is, Scott. It's very important. I remember when I was a union member of the MEBA, we were getting a lot of new members from outside the traditional, you know, state schools and Kings Point and stuff like that. And plus the union school was kind of winding down because our jobs had met their goal. I thought it would be good to orient all new members that didn't have labor relations courses in college to attend a course mandated to attend a course by the union to teach union history and teach all the ins and outs of labor law and union history. And our union was founded in 1875. So, I mean, we've been around a long time. Right. There's a rich history there. And some of it, you know, we don't want to get into because, you know, it was like one of those, like the Masons, you know, the Masons were involved. So, you know, where that goes.
Sure. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, some of it is tawdry, but you should know, you know, everybody should know where they came from. And it was passed overwhelmingly across the country. I went from port to port. You know, they have meetings on different days of the week in different parts of the country. And me and another guy went all across the country and got it passed overwhelmingly. And they didn't do a damn thing about it. They did nothing. Even though the resolution was passed, they never started it, and they never promoted it, they never did anything with it. So that was discouraging. That was very discouraging.
That was like the West Virginia opioid assisted care, right, with the Suboxone and things like that. They had a big study on it. They funded the study at West Virginia University. A friend of JB's in mine actually was in charge of it. And then they got through and said, yeah, it's a great program. And then they passed a statute approving of it and allocated absolutely zero funds.
Of course.
That's right. That's right.
The famous West Virginia thing there, you know.
Yeah.
You know, on the history side of things, you know, I lived in Alabama for a long time. There's a part of Alabama called Red Mountain. And Red Mountain, they mined iron ore.
And makes then, sense.
Huh?
Makes sense.
Yeah, and then they also smelted it. So it was a mining and manufacturing thing. This is way back. I can't remember, in the 1800s sometime. The IWW had set up the IWW, well, you guys know what the IWW was, but they had also set up a union organize, a separate kind of union thing. Anyway, to this day, if you go and look at, and they actually won that situation, and they have a museum there. And if you go there, one of the things that will just blow you away is that when you walk into the museum and see that they have pictures of the leadership of the strike and the union, it's half black and half white.
Hmm. Alabama, right?
Alabama in the 1800s.
Wow.
Yeah,
it's just amazing. And I tell people that, and I say, okay, you don't believe me, just go look at the picture.
Right.
That's right. Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thing. I mean, the strike action, for example, it's a little more difficult. Like you've been mentioning, you mentioned last week, I think, Scott, the emphasis of both Amazon and Starbucks on national, trying to move toward a national contract, national movement. Mm-hmm. Because obviously, you know, in both of those situations, if you were to strike one of the facilities or one of the Starbucks shops or even one of the fulfillment centers, considering that there's 300 of them and they're interconnected and workloads can go between one to another, they don't always have to, it's set up like almost internet traffic and routers. Right. So, you know, your ability to use your power, which is your power to withhold labor. Okay. If you don't have a national scope to it, at least enough of the industry where you're going to really affect the profits and the income of the employer, then, you know, you might get certified to have a bargaining order or something like that, but you'll sit there for 10 years and the company will keep offering you, you know, a worse agreement every time that you can't possibly until you have the strength to make them do something different.
That's right.
And they're cold-blooded about it. You know, I mean, if you get away from the table and go to the water fountain for a couple of minutes, they'll tell you right out what they're doing.
Yeah.
So, I think that aspect of the strike wave is, rather than looking at it primarily from a legal point of view, because you can, you know, if every time you're thinking about having a fight with a company, if you ask your lawyers, you know, what is there any problem with this? They're lawyers. They're going to say, yes, there's a problem with it.
Yeah, that's right.
They are. And they won't be lying. There's no risk involved.
That's right.
Lying, but if you listen to them, you'll never go on strike. Okay. You never will. Because they're not going to go on strike because, you know, that's just, how would they collect any fees if they went on? Yes. But I think that you know, the most important thing is, can you, when a strike takes place, can a social movement around it, you know, where the allies can figure out a way to play a role and the union can get a sense of mission that's a little bit broader than just its job, even though that may be where the origin of the issues is, but still you have to reach out. Look at this strike in Pittsburgh at the Pittsburgh Gazette, the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's a perfect example of where you have to have a social, political, community, whatever. That has to be on, right on the top of your list of things to do if you want to win.
Yep. I got a new advocate position here for all of us. I think you would agree. You know, they have museums in D.C. for, you know, history and African Americans and Indians and newspapers. They have a museum for just about every aspect of society. Why not labor?
Amen.
Why not labor history, brothers? Huh? Right here, right on Labor Beat. We did it.
Yeah.
Right, we're going to launch a campaign.
Well, we started it.
We started it. Let's do it. We got Biden. We got the best labor president ever in office right now. I think we should propose it to him. And Joe would love it. I mean, he could run on that.
Well, Joe's okay. I think he's a little bit behind FDR. But
We got to take advantage of our numbers. You know, we have popularity numbers. And how can these justices, you know, several of them are, you know, under investigation. I mean, we've never had that in our whole lifetime. I mean, we're old. All three of us, You put our numbers together, we're over 200 years old right here. Think about it.
Thank you. Thank you, JB. Yes.
That's 200 years of experience. We have never seen a Supreme Court this corrupt in all our lives.
Well, that's for sure.
I mean, that's it. That's the crux of it. I mean, we cannot obey these rulings because it's a corrupt court.
Well, that would be the question is should, I mean, if Biden is very pro-labor and, you know, he's asked to enforce this order, what's he going to do? I think we should ask him to not enforce it in that case. But.
Right. In the article, it said Sarah Nelson and Liz Shuler and O'Brien, the president of the union up there in the cement union, they all said that if this case is taken to the state court in Washington state, that the state Supreme Court will rule in their favor.
That's what I saw that, right.
Yeah, yes. I think that's significant. That tells you how far off, you know, the federal Supreme Court is.
Yeah.
But you know, I think the Supreme Court, unless they're impeached and somebody gets rid of them, that will be, or unless the president deliberately refuses to enforce one of their orders, they will prevail legally. They will.
Yeah. I mean, that's a whole nother show just talking about getting rid of these guys. I mean, my God, it's never been done. So, they're going to have to reinvent the wheel on this.
And the corruption is so out there in front of everybody.
I know. It's documented.
It's just.
It's disgusting.
But
I have one little. I know you're going to yell at me about this, but as much as I can't think of anything that Clarence Thomas has ever said in the court that I agree with. But on the other hand, I've listened to his wife. And I want to tell you, I think that guy is carrying a curse.
That's good. That's a good way to end the show, John.
Well, wait a minute. I want to, before we end the show, I want to say one other thing. You know that now I forgot what I was going to say.
See, that's all. That's 200 years of experience there. 200 years of forgetfulness.
I'm overwhelmed by his own memory.
Oh, I know what I was going to say. The AFL-CIO conventions now, and it's been for several years now, they always have a pre-convention discussion, and it's based on, one year I remember they invited every youth organization in the United States to send people to the pre-convention, and they have a whole thing about the unions with all these young people.
Good idea.
Yeah, and they do that every year for some constituency that they're supposed to be, that they're trying to build a relationship with. I mean they've done it with women. All the women organizations sent people, and I think that's a smart move. Yeah.
All right, everybody. Well, we've done about as long as most people are going to listen to podcasts. So thank you, guys. And let me see what happened. Maybe we can get I gave pretty short notice to Mark on trying to get on. I'm sure he had something else to do.
Yeah, that you was a great idea.
Yes, for next week, do it in advance. I got like 5 shows a week I'm trying to work with. And So I sometimes I'm a little late trying to.
So you want Scott and I to do a better job of helping?
Well, if you could help out, any help would be appreciated if you find somebody. I mean, there's a lot of great issues. I mean, I'm still would love to get somebody from Michigan to talk about how they turn back right to work, you know.
Yeah, some, right.
Yeah.
That shouldn't be too hard. Mm-hmm.
I noticed when we were talking to Josh that time about it, you know, I remember mentioning it, and I could tell he was thinking about it, right? Because even though the numbers and polls on abortion are not quite the same in West Virginia as they were in Michigan, still there, you know, it makes you think about who are the other allies, you know, what could you do, right? And my understanding is that in Michigan, it was kind of a serendipity, right? In other words, the labor movement figured out as the reapportionment, that redistricting thing that they did there, voting, not politics, something. I can't remember the name of the campaign, but they had had a victory, which did change the redistricting in Michigan. And then the women's movement got fired up over Roe v. Wade, right? Mm-hmm. And then labor got fired up about the redistricting and the possibilities it presented, right? But it came together just perfectly where they ended up with a majority in both houses and by a 4-vote margin killed right to work, which is just, wish we could replicate that a few other places. Don't you? Anyway. Yeah.
You know, another one that I would like to try to get somebody from is, you guys know about Mondragon?
Yeah. Yes, I do. Yeah.
It's the steelworkers.
In Spain, right?
Yeah. Well, it's now an international kind of thing going on, and the steelworkers are a part of it. And they've already taken a steel plant that made sheets of aluminum, and it was closed down, and they reopened it as a co-op, making blades for the windmills, and actually added workers to that situation, and they're all in the steelworkers union. And anyway, I think maybe having a show with somebody from that to talk about how all that works might be a good thing. The other idea I had, and I'll try to work on this one too, is that we all know what a fighter Pete Seeger was. For the labor movement, and by the way, the woman that Florence Reese, who wrote "Which Side Are You On," and Pete Seeger played it. She was I knew her before she died, and she was just such a firebrand. And I think that's when I met both of them when they were recording a thing. But anyway. There's a new, I guess it's a, anyway, it's on Facebook, by this guy, I can't think of his name right now, but he is doing everything about the history of Pete Seeger and this and that. And I was thinking he might be a good person to try to get on the show.
Yeah, anybody like that. Keep
so going. I'll see if I can get him.
And, JB can... He knows everybody in the state of West Virginia, pretty much.
Well, I can work on getting somebody. I finally got the pool open, so I've got a little time now to do some other things. So I'll get on it.
Right. Okay. Well, great, guys. Well, let's see. It's late, but everything comes next, right?
Yes. You got to say it, John. You got to say it, brother.
Okay. All right. Take care of each other. It's late, but everything comes next. See y'all next time.
Yeah. All right.